Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the great Christopher Nolan in his 2006 hit film, The Prestige. Returning on the show today to talk about The Prestige is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I think if you were going to show somebody who has never seen a Christopher Nolan film before, even not the Batman ones, I think this would be a great one to show because it has everything that's sort of his signature style. It's got his typical cast in it with Christian Bale and Michael Caine. It's got the nonlinear story structure where there's a lot of flashbacks and everything, and it's a very, you know, like a lot of his films, it's a film that makes you think, you know. It's not a typical story. You're kind of trying to figure out, piece together what the secrets are and what's really going on and what happens. So this is a really good example of a Nolan movie.
Yeah, especially if you're thinking of like Memento, mm-hmm. where you kind of play with space and time. Yeah, it's a perfect Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah, and when I was looking at the film, this is the second time I saw it, 4 years ago or so for the first time, and I forgot how many people are in this movie. I mean, you've got the Nolan regulars with Christian Bale and Michael Caine, but you also got Hugh Jackman. You've got Scarlett Johansson, mm-hmm. an early role for her, and Rebecca Hall, who's mm-hmm. been in a bunch of things now. That's an early role for her. And you got Andy Serkis, who's not wearing like green leotards for a change and doing animated people. But you also, surprisingly, you got David Bowie. Yeah, so just wow, what a cast.
What a cast. And you know, I think David Bowie, I think that was inspired.
Yeah.
He doesn't look anything like Nikola Tesla, but he has that sort of gravitas. You know, you look mm-hmm. at him, he has that look to him. And because he's well known, but you don't really know that much about him. It's sort of the same with Tesla.
Yeah, he actually gives a really, I mean, even though it's a small role, I thought he does a really good job as Nikola Tesla with that accent. There's that mysteriousness to him, like what's him and his assistant up to on that mountain with that machine. And yeah, and you know, Bowie, you know, obviously he's a great musician, but I think he's done, you know, with the roles he did this, you know, Labyrinth, right?
Labyrinth.
And a couple other movies. I think he's a pretty underrated actor.
Oh, me too. But I think it was great to pick him for this because, like you said, there's so many heavy hitting actors in the movie. I mean, how do you cast anybody to be Tesla with all that talent that will even stand out? You really mm-hmm. have to go all the way to David Bowie.
Yeah, you go something unusual, you know? And then, yeah, and Christian Bale, this, you know, it's almost like his role with, you know, is a little bit, reminds me a bit of his Bruce Wayne role in mm-hmm. Batman because, you know, here's a guy with a secret. Mm-hmm. He likes, you know, theatricality. He likes, you know, deceiving people and everything and, you know, keeping people in the dark like Batman. So Veal is like, once again, it was because he's a regular, it feels like a good pick for this role as the Prestige.
Yeah, it is kind of a Batman-esque role when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even actually when I watched American Psycho, like this is a bit unrelated, but even that role sort of, you can see a bit of Bruce Wayne in that role.
Yes, you can, because he's very wealthy and remote, and yeah, you can make that
case. And once again, harboring a secret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in the Prestige, though. He has he's more of an everyman. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like a regular guy. He's definitely not suave like the Angier character is. Mm-mm. Hugh Jackman's character.
Yeah, he's very more emotional and
earthy.
Well, yeah, well, at least when we figure out the secret, that's one side of him is very emotional and, you know, outspoken and everything.
But, you know, you bring up something interesting in that the disguise that he puts on is really, mm-hmm. in a way, kind of like Batman.
Yeah,
like it's an opportunity to have, you know, two identities.
Exactly. And then the other role is Hugh Jackman. I think over the years he's sort of been typecasted as Wolverine. I think mm-hmm. that's what most people see him as now. But I think with this role, and even in something like Prisoners from 2013, I think he shows that he's also a very good actor. He can really expand and do different things. He doesn't have to be just the mutant badass Wolverine like he is in all those movies.
Now, I haven't seen him on Broadway, but I understand his show is fantastic. So he's apparently a well-known stage actor, which makes it perfect for him to do this role because this whole setting is right before movies came along. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a chance to see people actually going out to see magic acts in vaudeville and how expensive it was, how dressed up everybody got. Mm-hmm. It's a really good way to see that period of time.
Yeah, and then even in the movie, when he gets the double, that guy is an alcoholic stage actor. So yep. he's even bringing that into it. Yeah, and then in He's also a singer, right? Because he was on Les Mis and everything. So he even brings that background of, you know, variety of a different tools and everything.
Right. And the ability to get on a stage and own it.
Exactly. And then, yeah, and I got to say, I also really liked Andy Serkis in the movie. I mean, I think Andy Serkis is an underrated actor just because we don't really see him much, because he's always wearing the green leotards and he's doing Gollum from Lord of the Rings or Caesar from the Planet of the Apes movies. But in this movie, he's not putting green leotards on. He's being himself, and he does a really good like New York accent, and I like his little the relationship he has with David Bowie as this assistant. They're almost like a Frankenstein and Igor,
depending. Yeah. Also, didn't you love the illusion when they did the joke about what's in your pocket?
Oh yeah, yeah. And he tells him exactly what it was.
Yeah. But just the pocket thing. It's for right out of Lord of the Rings, right out of The Hobbit, Gollum.
And then we talked about it earlier, how the story structure is once again like a lot of Nolan films. It's also very similar to Memento, because like in Memento, you're trying to figure out what the story is. There's a bunch of the time is really, there's flashbacks and flash forwards and everything. It's not a really linear structure with the story. And once again, this is right up Nolan's alley. And I think, you know, once again, you watch this film and you also see Memento, you can definitely tell it's the same guy directing it.
Yes, you're definitely right about that. The editing includes 146 time jump cuts.
Wow.
Where the next shot either flashes back or skips ahead, which averages to almost one timeline jump per minute of film. But you're never confused. You always know exactly where you are in time. So, he does it so well.
So you didn't, like, not once did you find that a little bit like distracting or jarring or a little bit tiresome? Or
I thought it kept the pace going, because it kept you trying to put all the pieces in order, which is, again, like Memento.
Yeah, and I think one film I think that did this terribly, which came out this year, was with a bunch of flashbacks and everything, was Suicide Squad.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Okay,
I think you told me it stunk the joint out.
Yeah, I've said it a lot of times, but it's like at the beginning of the film, that film, there's all these flashbacks, and they're trying to introduce each of the characters, and it's like, here's the Will Smith character, flashback, he's doing something, flash forward, and here's this character, flashback to this character, come back, and here's this character. They just kept doing, and that got really irritating after a while. Spoiler alert, but when it's revealed that there are Christian Bale, the reason why he's able to pull off this magic effect is because he has a twin brother, and they've been living, they've been going in and out of one being Fallon and one being the real guy for a long time. So did you guess the reveal? Did you figure it out? Because I didn't guess it the first time, but it's sort of like when you watch Fight Club for the second time, you pick out the little details and you're like, oh yeah, now I can see it.
Yeah, all the clues are there. Mm-hmm. I did not get it the first time I watched it, even though the kid says, well, where's the bird's brother?
Mm-hmm. Yep,
you know, even I was a little, I wondered what it meant, but I just thought it meant ordinary relationship stuff. When Rebecca Hall's character says to him, you know, do you love me? And he says, yes. And she says, well, you don't really mean it. I mean, you meant it the other day, but today you don't mean it. I thought, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
But once you realize what it means, it's completely obvious.
Yeah, so that probably answers my next question. So you think she knew about them being twins from the get-go?
She does, and in fact, she added a line that wasn't in the script. She says, I know what you are. Mm-hmm. And she said she felt terrible right after she said it. They left it in, but she felt like she'd given it away. Hmm. I didn't think so, because I'm like you. I didn't know for sure.
I didn't get it either, yeah.
If she really understood.
I remember watching the movie the first time. I was trying to figure out, who is this Fallon guy? Because they keep cutting to him. He doesn't say anything. Like, what's his? There's got to be something more to this guy. And then you reveal that, it's revealed. But yeah, when you're watching the film the first time, like you said, you're trying to figure out. You can't quite get it. But then when you watch it the second time, it's like, oh, how could I have missed that?
Yeah, and you also see, like, when Rebecca Hall's character tells him, she thinks it's her husband, that she's pregnant. He's like, oh, and Fallon just left. Oh, he'd be so happy to hear that. And you think, what a weird reaction.
Mm-hmm. And then even when the characters reveal that he has the affair with the mistress, you know, we can tell that, you know, in certain situations when they have that dinner and he's kind of blowing up, you can tell that the Fallon character has shown more concern and appreciation for Sarah, the wife. And the other guy, he doesn't like her. He just wants to be with the mistress.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, very tricky stuff. And also when Angier's character asks Borden, well, which knot did you use? And he says, I don't know. It's like, how can you not know?
Mm-hmm. Once again, it's because it was the other guy.
Because it was the other guy.
And then one thing I also thought, if you feel like this was a hint, when they at the beginning, when they're studying that Chinese magician show,
yes,
and they figure out like the reason why he's able to pull off that stunt, because he isn't really what he is, like this old cripple, he's in perfectly fine health, but he shows such extreme dedication to doing that, he's able to convince the audiences that it's magic, even though if he was in perfect shape, he wouldn't be able to pull it off.
That was actually based on a real person.
Oh, really?
Yes. That stage character, there was a stage character created by a Caucasian-American man, William Ellsworth Robinson, who disguised himself as a Chinese man to cash in on audiences' enthusiasm for the exotic.
Hmm.
He lived as Chung, never breaking character while in public.
Wow.
And then he died in March 1918 when a bullet catch trick went wrong. My God, I've been shot. Those were his last words and the first English he had spoken on stage in 19 years. So it's a study in single-mindedness, the whole movie is.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's another one of those giveaways, too, because mm-hmm. Angier is telling his wife, you know, I didn't see it, but Borden got it right away. Well, of course Borden got it right away. Borden already knew what it meant to...
You know, show extreme dedication. They even
yes.
talk about it. It's extreme dedication. He's living the act even after that. Because the big thing at the end where you figure out they're doing extreme dedication, because when that bullet catch trick
yes.
goes wrong and he loses two of his fingers, he had to keep up the trick. And because it was suggested by Scarlett Johansson, they have to have mm-hmm. the other guy cut his fingers off so they can look exactly the same.
Yeah, talk about dedication,
yeah.
especially the second guy. Yeah, and another thing that's a little bit of a clue is that the characters' names are really Albert and Frederick, but they become Alfred.
Oh.
But Scarlett Johansson's character keeps talking to the man she's in love with and calling him Freddie.
Mm-hmm.
And when she's with the wrong twin, he says, you know, that's not my name.
Yep. Do you think, we would talk about Rebecca Hall pretty much figured out. Do you think Scarlett Johansson ever figured it out? Or
I'm going to say no, because she was so angry when, you know, and you have to think, which one was it? Talking to her about, well, you know, it doesn't really matter that, you know, things aren't working out with my wife because I don't love her anyway. I never did. You know, I love you. And she's horrified.
Mm-hmm.
How can you say that? And how can you be so cold about it? Well, if she knew, it would mm-hmm. make perfect sense.
Yeah. So, I don't think she picked it up either. Now, okay. So, a little bit, now that the one twin is alive and that was the one that, that was the one that was in love with Sarah Rebecca Hall. That was the one that survived. Do you think he would go to Scarlett Johansson and tell her the truth about what happened, or do you think he'll just go in hiding or something?
Well, I kind of hope he levels with her, don't mm-hmm. you?
Yeah. Okay, and then, now, so the ending of the movie, this is, you know, once again, just sort of like the ending of Inception or even the ending of Memento. It's got a big twist. It's something that you have to kind of maybe watch a couple of times to fully get. So did you like the ending of the film when it's sort of revealed that that Hugh Jackman had this duplicator machine, so the reason why he was able to pull that trick off is because he would kill the duplicate and then have the other person, and he would be the one on the stage and do the big reveal. Did that work for you? Do you think that was a little bit too fantastical or whatever?
It worked for me because I bought into the illusion part of it, you know, just suspension of disbelief. What I thought was a little bit harder to grasp is that he did it that way so that he could eventually frame Borden for mm-hmm. his own death, which meant he had this whole warehouse of, you know, dead versions of himself. Why didn't he just make one clone and then he would have a twin? He wouldn't have had to kill himself every night. He had just gone so far into the dark side that it mm-hmm. wasn't even about being the one with the trick that nobody could figure out. He had to destroy the other guy.
Yeah, once again, it kind of goes back to that theme of obsession you're talking about, where, you know, even if I got to do this amazing magic trick, even if it means killing, you know, killing my clone every night, killing all these duplicates every night, I got to do it. So what? Even if I'm a murderer, I'll still do it.
I think he was afraid. I think, and I'm speculating, of course, but since he did have such a dark side and was so angry, I think he feared that the clone would turn on him. And how mm-hmm. would he be able to say, that's the clone, I'm the real one? I mean, there's something scary about creating your own clone. I can mm-hmm. see why you would want to immediately dispose of it. But I don't know if, how you would deal with that whole basement mm-hmm. full of of all the dead clones.
The thing is, didn't he have the blind people so they couldn't see it?
Yes.
So he would have them sort of, I'm assuming they would just dump it in the river or something.
Right.
Just where nobody could find it. But so the whole thing with the duplicate, everything else is pretty much grounded in reality. You know, you always figure out what the magic trick is. It's always this, that, or the other thing. And even the big reveal, well, they're just twins.
Mm-hmm.
That's nothing fantastical. But this one is fantastical. It's you know, not realistic. It's a duplicating device that sort of creates a clone of yourself. Did that like? Did you kind of like? Oh, did you not like that in any way, or did that not bother you?
I thought it was kind of clever, because I thought it was clever the way when it was Tesla doing it, you know, it was cats in hats. I thought that was really cool, the way they chose those objects, because they were really interesting when they multiplied.
Yeah, the two little cats fighting each other, and then all the hats lying around.
And it also seemed like a warning, like this could be... I mean, the cats seemed really hostile. The hats, you couldn't tell because they're inanimate.
Hat, yeah.
But you wonder, you know, what happens? What are the implications? You're already thinking about the implications of that before you think about doing it with a person.
Yeah, that's what even David Bowie was telling him. I mean, Nikola Tesla was telling him. He was like, what you do when you get this thing is put it in the river.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like lots of things. Things may work, but it's going to cost you more than you think you're going to.
Yeah, once again, kind of going back to that whole Frankenstein's monster creation. And so,
you like the end? I mean, how did you feel about the clones?
I liked it. I mean, I can understand if people felt like the duplicate thing was like on this movie that's mostly grounded in reality, have this one fantastical thing. But I thought the way they dealt with that and just how dark Hugh Jackman goes, where he's killing off these clones every night and then he's going to frame them for murder, that didn't bother me that much. And that even so, the duplicate thing goes, that kind of goes back to all these set of doubles that we see with him and then with Christian Bale and the twins. So that part didn't bother me that much. It worked well.
I'm a little surprised that Michael Caine's character wasn't watching Fallon more closely and picking up on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently back in this time in Victorian magic, using a twin for the transport of man kind of thing was really common.
Oh, really?
So it's key that Borden never is known as two guys. His twinness is never known.
Hmm.
It's like their whole lives they have to have figured out that they want to be one person who shares one life. That's really unusual when you think about it.
Yeah, exactly. And so you don't think Michael Caine ever figured out the reveal?
I don't know. Do you? Because when
maybe,
he was at the trial, he seemed like he really thought Borden killed Algier. He's shocked when he finds Lord Caldlow is really Hugh Jackman's character.
What about the very scene at the end when, spoiler alert, but when Christian Bale goes and kills Hugh Jackman? Wasn't that Bale at the end kind of Bale interacting with Caine in the street just before he enters the building?
Oh, I didn't put that together.
So maybe they figured it out at the end. But. So one thing I learned was that this book was based, the movie was based on a novel by the same name by Christopher Priest. I was wondering if you've read it or anything.
I have downloaded it, but I've never read it. I know certain of the plot points are different. The wife doesn't die in a, you know, the thing of water. Which was totally setting you up for the ending.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so, you know, it's interesting when you look at all the films in his filmography. You mean everybody talks about the Dark Knight trilogy, I mean, even later stuff like Inception or Interstellar, or maybe even like, you know, when they talk about his earlier stuff like Memento. But this one, it's always the one that seems to me always a little bit forgotten. Do you feel like that?
Do you feel too.
People forget it?
I do too. I used to use it in American cinema because I wanted to show what the world looked like and how people dressed and where they went out to amuse themselves before there were movies. Like literally right before. I mean, it's so close to that technology happening, but it's right at that moment. And it I think it's a forgotten gem. And they're always shocked when they find out it's Christopher Nolan. But I think it's intellectually stimulating. It's got a little bit of a puzzle to it. When you figure it all out, you realize you should have gotten it the whole time. I just think it's very cleverly done.
Yeah, and that's what I always enjoy. That's why I really, Christopher Nolan is one of my favorite directors out working now, is because he's always makes some movies that make you think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not just, you know, you can...
Not just visual potato chips.
Yeah, not just stuff you can, you know, stuff your face full of popcorn and just you know, tune out for a bit. And sure, I like, you know, mindless action movies. Like I talked earlier about how much I like John Wick. That's not a movie that necessarily makes you think and has a puzzling ending, but it's still fun. But this movie, like, makes you think. You're always thinking about the ending. You're trying to guess. Even after you've seen it the first time, you're trying to get the clues at the second time, like we've talked about. And I just don't get why so many people hate him so much. It's just like he's...
Christopher Nolan?
Yeah, there's a lot of people on the internet who say, he's overrated, all his films are stupid, or they're always have these too many plot holes. I'm just thinking, he's one of the few directors out there who's going to work within a studio making big budget movies. A lot of them come out in the summer, and they're going to be like, they're not just stupid, they're make you think. They have these cerebral endings, you know. I just never get why people hate them.
I don't get it either. In fact, when I find something as a Christopher Nolan movie, I just think there's going to be something in it for people who want to think, which is rare.
Exactly. Once again, you've just hit the nail on the head. It makes people think. They're like, even in Interstellar, you know, with that ending, and you know, you're thinking about the actual science involved, or even in, you know, even his more popcorn movies like the Batman trilogy. Those aren't like your typical fun Superman movies. There's a lot of talking about technology, like in The Dark Knight when he uses that system which kind of records over everybody in Gotham just so he can get the Joker. They talk about, you know, Morgan Freeman doesn't like the ethics in that case.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something in there to think about in his movies. It's not just goofy fun.
Or mindless action, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So of his other movies, which other ones would you say? I mean, as a kid growing up as a Batman fan, I would have to say The Dark Knight I also really like, but I haven't really, there hasn't really been any of his movies that I haven't liked. I've seen all of them, and all of them at the very worst get a B+ for me.
I agree. But I would put Memento right up there near the top because mm-hmm. it was so unlike, and it's still unlike any other movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's told forward and backward at the same time. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And then just that movie, and then with something like Inception or Interstellar, where mm-hmm. you get a really good story, but amazing visual effects.
Yes.
Where like Inception, where there's the buildings coming on top of each other, or Interstellar when the black hole,
or a wormhole?
Wormhole.
You end up behind the bookcase.
Yeah, just he always makes everything good, and I can't wait for his next film. Have you seen the trailers for Dunkirk?
I have, and I'm wondering what he's going to add into a movie that historical that's going to have that kind of magical realism. You know, because that is one of the nice things about The Prestige. The whole thing feels like a magic trick. Mm-hmm. And the movies that you mentioned have these wonderful moments where things fold in on themselves in a way that doesn't make sense, but it works on the screen and it's exciting. So how do you do Dunkirk?
Yeah, that's...
with all that kind of talent? I mean, how do you...
I know, looking at the trailers, once again, he has his usual cast. Not Michael Caine or Christian Bale, but he's got Tom Hardy, who's mm-hmm. probably my favorite actor out right now. You got Scarecrow, Cillian Murphy in it. So with those guys, you know, who knows what's going to happen? I think this is a big cast. I think it's definitely not the most popular, like, historical topic in World War II, because that was early on in the war, and it's just it's a big evacuation effort. But, you know, people talk about D-Day or, like, you know, Pacific Islands like Iwo Jima or something, and usually in war movies. Like, this is a battle in World War II that I don't think it's talked about a lot. It's kind of cool that they're finally bringing it up in a movie.
Do you think they're going to flash forward and backwards into the characters' backstories? That would be Nolan-esque.
I think we're going to see that at least once. I think, once again, this is speculation, but looking at the trailer, because Cillian Murphy's character, it looks like he just escaped from a sinking boat, and he's got to go back to Dunkirk because he's picked up by one of the civilian boats that are going
right
to pick up the soldiers. So I think we'll probably see some flashbacks with him. And then there's some soldiers who are also escaping. I think they're not the Tom Hardy ones, but we'll probably see some flashbacks from them too. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, just anything that guy does, like, I'm on board.
Yeah, I'll at least give it a shot. He hasn't disappointed me in any of the movies he's made.
Okay, I'll give you one. Have you ever seen his first film, Following?
No.
It's a good one. A very, very low budget. This was like 2 years before he did Memento. And it's sort of this, it's a noir film. It's sort of this guy who just, he kind of has this hobby of following people. And sort of he follows this one guy who catches him. And this guy is a robber. He invades people's homes when they're out on vacation and steals stuff. And so after that, they get involved in this crime that kind of goes a bit crazy, and there's the woman involved, so great noir film. Once again, very Nolan-esque, some flashbacks and flash-forwards and everything, but it's a good recommend. It's, and even if you don't like it, it's only like an hour and a, less than an hour and a half long, so you won't waste a lot of your time anyway.
I will definitely look for that.
Okay, and then one other question is, so you talked a little bit, so when you talked about why you chose this film for your class, is it more just to show what, you know, what was considered movies before movies were?
Yeah, that mostly, and also because, you know, so many students who take American cinema, they know all about Batman. So it's like, well, here's something that that director did that you probably haven't seen. And by the way, you know everybody in it. You know Michael Caine, you know Scarlett Johansson, mm-hmm. you know Christian Bale, you know Hugh Jackman, you know Piper Perabo, you know David Bowie.
Yeah.
So there's so much there that they will go along with. They'll be right on board with, oh, it's Christopher Nolan, it's all these people that, you know, you're showing them a period of time they're not familiar with, but it's got all this familiarity in it. It's a perfect movie.
So when has the reception for that film been pretty positive, would you say?
I think the movie, yes, did very well.
And, oh, no, I mean in your class.
Oh, in my class, yes. Although it is very complicated. They do get a little bit like, well, what's the deal with all the cats in the hats? Mm-hmm. They do kind of, that is a little bit vague what goes on there.
Yeah,
why are they all outside?
So some might not particularly care for that duplicator plot device?
It's like everything is fine until you get to Tesla. And mm-hmm. then for some students, it falls apart. That whole machine that he makes, the unbelievability of it, I think that is a stumbling block for some people.
Yeah, and it didn't bother me that much, but I can definitely see why some people don't like it.
It's like magic tricks are one thing, delving into the supernatural is another.
Okay. And so we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I forgot to talk about that you want to bring up now?
Well, I did want to tell you that the infant that Borden has is actually played by one of Christopher Nolan's children.
Oh, okay.
But if you were either of these characters, either of the magicians, would you have made different choices? Would you live a double life? Would you go see Tesla?
Either Hugh Jackman or Christian mm-hmm. Bale? That's a good question. Would I make different decisions? I think in a situation like that, the beginning when they tie up the woman and for the magic trick, I would have made sure just not to have. I think he wanted to experiment with a knot. They were talking about that. I would have not done that. Mm-hmm. I think that whole thing, just something little thing like that, that whole kickstarted this whole rivalry. And I think if you didn't do that, then they might have gotten on a lot better.
What do you think about the fact that the twins living one life meant they had to lie to two women?
Yeah, and I think that's also just like whenever you're with, like the one guy could have been just only with Scarlett Johansson, the one he likes, and then the one guy could have just been with his wife, or he could have just revealed to him, like, look, we're twins, you know. I think that would have just saved everybody a lot of trouble, and his wife wouldn't have killed herself.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would have made a lot more different decisions. Okay, and then last question I'll have for you is just tell us about the classes you teach.
Well, this semester I'm teaching women in film. I am teaching world cinema, and I am teaching history of animated film. This film doesn't fit into any of those categories, but I did use it in American cinema. Right now I'm teaching American cinema online, so this isn't one of our offerings, but it's a great example of really good movie making and editing.
Mm-hmm. Once again, he's top notch, and you just got to see whatever. I'm always game whatever he makes, even if it's like an Adam Sandler comedy. I'll probably check it out anyway.
So we'll have to talk about Dunkirk once it comes out.
Oh, definitely. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about director Christopher Nolan and his 2006 film, The Prestige. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or any time at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, are you watching closely?